Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline, and Pam Short's broken both her legs, and I want to dance with you. And she's been training for the Pan Pacific Grand Prix since she was 6 years old. It's Kate Young.
It is true. Since I was six, I'm still not ready. I'm like, could ready. Never be less ready.
You're an open amateur. For me, as a beginner, to approach
amateur.
You.
You could have said 14,000 lines as well. Like, every single one of the lines could have been the opening there.
And what's so funny about it is that, like, there's so many fabulous, mad, bonkers pieces of dialogue in this movie. And almost none of them are spoken by the two leads.
Indeed.
The two leads, there is so little dialogue between them.
Yeah.
Between Scott and Fran. And that, yeah, they're the main love story. But it's like, no, all of their communication happens really through dance.
Really through dance, yes.
Even their first kiss is like 3 seconds. Their only kiss is like 3 seconds. And then he goes, oh no.
Oh no. Exactly the response you don't want after this guy you've been fancying for years is like, oh, I will actually, I notice you as a human now. Yeah. Let's kiss. Oh, no.
Oh, no. I said I would teach.
Oh, the bongo pongo.
The bogo pogo.
Bogo pogo. Yeah.
I feel like it changes every time they say it slightly.
Maybe just in my head.
So, this is, I think listeners will notice this new season has a strong Australian inflection.
Indeed.
And that's not an accident because I am mentally and physically preparing to go to Australia in October.
Exciting.
It's so exciting. I was going to use this this opportunity to plug tickets, but they've all sold out.
Great. Perfect.
So
so instead, we're just doing a nice podcast celebrating your imminent trip to Australia.
Yes, exactly.
Great,
and it's like I do... There's obviously limits to what pop culture can give us, and it can't completely prepare you for, you know, the emotional character of a country. But I think Strictly Ballroom can prepare me for Australia.
I think it really can. And also I thought really hard about which film we would engage with or which piece of art we would engage with that said something about Australia that was interesting.
Yeah. And I think what really struck me about watching this movie again, because I've seen it many times, I actually studied
it. Please talk about your... Yeah.
So strange. So the Irish Leaving Cert, which is the sort of our A-levels, or what are they in Australia?
It's just your like high school certificate.
Yeah,
basically, it depends on what state you grew up in.
Okay.
But yeah.
See, I'm learning already.
Yeah. Education is a mess, but depending on which state you're in.
There is a part of the English Leaving Cert paper called Comparative Lit. And basically, there are a bunch of films, novels and plays that are assigned to comparative lit, and it is up to your English teacher. I think theoretically it should be up to you. I think what they're trying to encourage is like
engage with these texts.
Engage with the text and also see the relation between texts, kind of thing. But essentially your English teacher picks her 3 favorite things, and let's face it, it's always a her.
Great. Yep.
And so
in my experience too, actually.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it has to be one book, one play, one movie. The 3 that we ended up from the sort of like if you imagine panning in a river for gold, and the 3 nuggets that came into our class were Wuthering Heights.
Yep.
The novel, not the song.
Indeed.
Brian Friel's Philadelphia, Here I Come, and Baz Luhrmann's Strictly Ballroom.
Absolutely bananas collection of things.
I think it's why my brain is the way it is.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that checks a lot of boxes of like, oh, this is an introduction to culture.
Yeah.
This is how we're going to do it.
It's all connected.
Yeah.
I think if all of us had been slightly older,
yeah,
we would have engaged with it more as an intellectual pursuit. But it was just like themes of intergenerational trauma. Heathcliff punishes Kathy's children, and Shirley punishes Scott.
Because Doug wanted to dance weird steps, and then she was lied to, and
yes, and yeah. Barry Fife is the
Barry Fife is the devil. Yeah.
So that's my experience of it. What's your experience of it?
So my experience of it is that it is not the first Baz Luhrmann I watched. So okay. I was about the right age for Moulin Rouge in the cinema to form an mm-hmm. enormous part of my personality.
Yes, it's 2001.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I was about 14 mm-hmm. and to go and see that as somebody who already liked musicals and theatricality
right
and
for the
performance
plucking.
Was right for the plucking. And so I then, the same year, was studying Romeo and Juliet at school. So obviously then watched Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet and was like, oh, this is me, all this of this. Me. This is my personality. Yeah. And then watched Strictly Ballroom. And that, as a trilogy, remains very, very close to my heart, very deep in my soul, very much had an impact on the way that I sort of engage with cinema. Yeah. It was huge to me when I was a kid. And Strictly Ballroom is the one that I think I still watch the most. Mm. It's the one as well that since moving to the UK, I've watched the most with English people or people who grew up somewhere else. And occasionally you have the joy of kind of getting to watch somebody watch a film that has meant something to you. And trying not to be a creep about it, but also having
so hard not to be a creep
because there's so many good lines and so many good moments that you're like, I'm looking to the right. I shouldn't be looking to the right. Just watch the screen. Watch the screen. Don't be weird. Don't be weird. but much like my relationship with Moonstruck, which is I loved it as a young teenager and have showed it to innumerable friends now, I have the same relationship with Strictly Ballroom where either I talk about it and somebody goes, what I want and does the lines, or they haven't seen it and then we have to watch it and they're the only two options.
And it was funny because you watched it with our dear mutual friend Tash Hodgson,
star of stage and screen
whose face is currently on buses and cabs in London.
Totally
very weird for someone you've known for 12 years. She watched it with you,
who had never seen it,
and her first reaction was, when are they going to sing?
Why is she not singing? Why has this woman walked into a room, performed like that, and then the next moment hasn't been a big musical number where she walks out into another room and does a big number on her own?
Right?
It does feel like it should be a musical. And it made a lot of sense to me that he made Moulin Rouge. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes a lot of sense that this is the debut of a man who will go on to make Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet I think, strangely, this Strictly Ballroom feels in a way the least of its time or something. I don't know. I look at Moulin Rouge and I think, and I love it. I adore it.
Yes.
But it, the phrase that always comes to me is, this is a pre-9/11 movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was like, this was an indicator of like turn of the century film before the turn of the century became known for something else.
Yes.
And it's like, it's too much. It's opulent. It's, I don't know. This is something
gaudy and brilliant, but like in a way that, like, it's pre-financial crash, pre-9/11, us reckoning with the world.
Totally.
In a way that, because Strictly Ballroom, despite being bananas, like, the script is mad and the way that people engage with each other is mad, the performances are so heightened, but it does feel quite rooted and
timeless in its madness. Yeah.
Because you can't quite pin these people down. You don't know where they are or what's going on with them.
Yes.
But they do feel real, like, oddly real.
Right.
And I think part of that is not having a lot of money to make the film.
Yeah.
Like part of that is having a budget of $3 million and pulling all of this together. And part of it is it starting as a stage play.
Yes.
And part of it is his camera style at the time, which is it happens subsequently. But at this point is just, I was really paying attention to it yesterday. Never seen so many close-ups in a film. Like, people's faces fill the entire screen and they are sweaty and working, and you can feel the reality of them in a way that I think Moulin Rouge distances you from everyone.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And even Romeo and Juliet, it's so hyper-stylized.
Yeah, and like, the language is always going to be as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah, and it's I love all three movies for very different reasons, but for some reason this and I think it is because it's a low budget and also because it's about low budget people.
It is.
It's about, like, you know, lower middle class people.
Yeah.
And they kind of always look the same. We always look the same, know? It's just like, slightly shitty clothes, slightly shitty makeup, and like trying really hard.
Yep.
You know?
Working really hard, trying to do a thing.
Yeah. And it also, it really put me in mind as well. I think there's, Muriel's Wedding, obviously a strong comparative touch point for this. And obviously the 90s were a great time for Australian cinema.
A really great time for Australian cinema. So many of my favourite bits of Australian art come out of the 90s.
Yeah.
And it is Strictly Ballroom and then Muriel's Wedding and The Castle, which you might not have
I've
seen.
I've never heard of that, no.
It's amazing. It's set in like the outer suburbs of Melbourne, right by the airport. And it's about a family who are trying to keep their home when the airport is going to expand and wants to compulsorily acquire their house. And they take it up to the High Court to fight it, to keep their home. It's beautiful.
It sounds gorgeous. And I would love to watch it with you, hopefully.
Yes, please. And also Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which I think like that same decade. And I think that the like 60s to 80s of Australian filmmaking was very much like reckoning with the outback and the space and this land and our relationship to it, and a sort of real reckoning of like, what is our place here? What is, and when I say our, I very much mean people who were making films at that time, which is mostly white European people, you know, who'd been in Australia for generations, but who had displaced a people who had a relationship with that land that we, I, as a white Australian, am never going to have.
Mm.
And the 90s feels very much more a sort of suburban reckoning.
Yes, yes,
like coming into cities and not, it's so striking to me that this film feels like deeply, deeply Australian, and not just because of the accents, but you never see a shot of the beach or the opera house or a eucalyptus tree even, or like anything that feels like demonstrably, visibly Australia. But watching this film, I can like smell Australia.
Yes.
It smells like humidity and bitumen and petrol and eucalyptus trees and like all of the stuff that you in a month are going to go, oh yeah, you're right, there is a very specific thing here that isn't what we smell here on the street every day.
And I think so. I'm so glad that you brought up the Australian art as inherently dealing with it, the country physically and the country historically. Because I whenever I, you know, watch something Australian, it does seem that there's often a very hermetically sealed vibe to it that is very, reminds me of like a John Waters movie. It's like heightened suburbia, heightened indoorsness kind of thing. And it's and that sort of makes sense, you know, in terms of, oh, a very hot country where you know it's very uncomfortable to be outside for long periods of the day, and so we have great air conditioning indoors, so let's all go in there and chat. and that makes sense. But it's also this sense of like, and there's another movie I want to reference in a minute that is very much about this as well. The sense of like the existential terror of living in a place where everything can kill you. Like, I think that's what people in this hemisphere find so troubling about Australia, is like there's snakes, there's lizards, there's things that you can't even think about. Is lizards with knives in their mouths.
Yeah. You know? And I went speed dating like earlier this year.
Yes, which I would love to do a whole episode on, because I love that speed dating story so much.
Yeah. I was on, I had 3 minutes with this woman and I sat down, said hello, and she instantly went, oh my God, are you from Australia? Uh-huh. And I went, yes, I've been here 15 years, but yes, I am from Australia. And she went, and she just spent the entire 3 minutes talking about snakes. She just wanted to talk about the fact that, how did I possibly grow up there? It must be so terrifying. You must have seen so many snakes. And I've seen like 5 snakes in my life in a way that felt like, oh, we are in each other's space in a way that is making me uncomfortable. You know, the way
you talked about that snake like it was a predator. I said like they a sexual are. Predator. I mean, they are. No,
you're right.
They are. Yeah.
But that thing where it's not just, oh, there's something over there and it's not bothering me. But it's like, oh, I've lifted the lid of my filter box off in the pool and there is a red-bellied black snake in the filter box ready. Or I'm taking a group of year 10 students on biology camp and we're in a sand mine and suddenly an enormous brown snake goes in front of the group and the man running the tour is like, I think we'll, bus, yeah, let's just turn, bus, yeah, let's go back to the bus.
Kate, you're making me want to cancel my ticket.
No. But what I'm saying is I lived there for 20 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have had so few of these experiences. Like, so few. It's just not a thing that happens. And in my domestic house, it almost never happened. Like, I grew up in a suburb of Brisbane and the sort of fear that people talk about and all of the reckoning with the danger of the land and the space was not a thing that I spent an enormous time thinking about.
And yet it preoccupies everybody who doesn't live in Australia.
But it really does preoccupy everyone who's not there, right?
Yeah. And it's like Australia to me, in my imagination, is like in the Garden of Eden, instead of punishing Adam and Eve by throwing them out, God added more snakes.
I was like, you can stay.
You can stay.
But you can have more of these guys.
You can put on a tank top and some running shorts.
Yeah.
And you have more snakes.
Yes.
But the reason I bring it up is because it seems like it's in order to psychologically deal with the existential threat that is the continent.
Yes.
It's like we make things smaller and more compact and more tight. So it's like Strictly Ballroom is so much a film that's preoccupied with like our community, our little hobby, our committees, our like local competitions. Tight, tight, tight. Keep all the snakes out by
and,
tight,
and
tight,
to the
tight.
Point where outside of that, these people must have jobs and lives because they're all amateur dancers.
This is hobby.
You see like 10 seconds of Ken Rawlings having a pool spa company.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the women being a hairdresser and stuff.
Yeah.
But our central characters, we have no sense of their lives outside of this. What does Scott aspire to, apart from dancing his own steps at the Pan Pacific Grand Prix?
It's so funny because any other movie, like an American movie, I think, or just not by a mad genius that is Baz Luhrmann, or was Baz Luhrmann for these three films?
Indeed,
because
his
genius is not prolific.
Let's just talk about these three films and then I will talk about him with pure love.
Yes, exactly. Like an American movie would have like Scott working on his car and sort of like he's a mechanic by day and dances by night, and they would have gone out of their way to overemphasize his masculinity and he's a straight guy. Look, here he is working on a car, here he is on a skateboard under a car, now he wipes off the oil of his hands and dances with the frumpy girl.
Totally. And they're both I think they're both supposed to be about 18, which he is clearly not. He is like 28 when they filmed this. But they're both supposed to be 18. And so I guess that the point of this is he's supposed to win the Pan Pacific Grand Prix and then he will take over the dance school. Like that could be his future. But for Fran, it's like she will have just finished school. Uh-huh. Is she going to uni? Is she getting a job? Is she doing a thing? We have genuinely, apart from seeing her sit on her family's back deck and dance, we have no sense. And I'm not, this isn't criticism. This is like fascination with how tight and small this story is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like how brilliant it is that a film that makes me feel this much and laugh this much and engage this much is about something that genuinely doesn't matter.
Well, this
like it does, but it doesn't.
But it doesn't. It's like, and it's so from the opening, it does such a great job of telling you how big a deal this is to these people, but how small a deal it is generally.
Yeah.
Because even like you have, you know, as the red curtain trilogy, you have the opening with the red swishy, beautiful curtain. Then you have this kind of very sort of 1930s era kind of Fred Astaire dance sort of silhouetting thing going on with all these, you know, debonair men and women and dancing and stuff. And then immediately once we get behind that, it's like, oh, they're in like very much a hall.
Yes.
This is a hall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're in a rented hall.
A rented hall.
Yeah.
And they even the final scene, which is the Pan Pacific Grand Prix that we've been heading towards the entire time.
Not well attended.
It's not well attended. there's no people there. You know, there's a nice crowd, but it's mostly family coming to watch these people who are dancing. It's more dancers than anyone else.
Yeah.
And it's just these people who care deeply about this thing that the rest of the world are like,
And I guess, and that's what's so lovely about it, I guess, is because, you know, the jobs that we do get mentioned in this is like, you know, Shirley's a beauty, cause she's basically an Avon lady, know? And, you know, Fran's family owns some kind of cantina or whatever. There's someone mentions like a landscape gardening business. Someone quits
in order
to focus on the
landscape gardening business. Yeah,
it's like they all have these very workaday jobs, but in this world, they are somebody.
Oh yeah,
and that is actually what it's about. It's like they've all forgotten anything they like or love about ballroom dancing or dancing itself. Yeah. But they're like, if they eat and sleep and breathe this subculture enough, they will ascend through the ranks of it and have power over one another.
Yes.
And that's really what it's about.
Yeah, they will be the name that people run into a room talking about.
Yeah.
And like Fran has never been that person. And in my head after the film, it's like the conclusion of the film is so interesting because in a sort of sports film structure, what you would have to do is either have them win or not win, but in a very specific way.
Yes.
And what happens is we don't know who wins.
We don't know because
they don't care.
Besides the point,
it's literally beside the point. All they wanted to do was go to the Pan Pacific Grand Prix and dance Scott's steps.
The Latin final.
The Latin final. That's it. Like this isn't even about winning.
Yeah.
It's not about any of that.
And it's like because this is a like any subculture, it is. You need to know a lot to understand what anyone's doing right or wrong.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, unless the voiceover is in the form of the mockumentary, we're telling us that Scott has done something heinous.
Yes.
There's no way we would know. And that's the joke.
Totally. You know? We have no concept of this. The sort of the strictly ballroom idea is not a thing we can recognize. So you have to, it is a bananas beginning to the film because you spend the first 10 minutes going, oh, it's a mockumentary.
Uh-huh.
The whole thing's going to be a mockumentary. You have like people's names under their faces and everyone's doing these two camera interviews about this thing that went wrong. And then it vanishes never to return.
Nope.
As a framing device and a concept.
Uh-huh.
But you're right, we need it because we need to have a sense that there are these stringent, specific rules in this world that Barry Fife has laid out and can monetize. Because if you can't sort of police the steps, you can't teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to teach
them. Their whole fragile economy.
Exactly. Their whole fragile economy is built around, I will tell you what these specific steps are, which ones you're allowed to do in order, and then you will go out and do them. And then there will be another generation who do the same, who do the same, who do the same. Uh-huh. And if you step outside of that, you're going to crack this ecosystem wide open. We don't know how to survive it.
Yes, exactly. We don't know how to survive
it. And that's mad that I, you know, have that sense from that first, you know, 5-10 minutes.
Yeah,
and you're so clear on it.
What I love about it as well is that this, this, you know, committees and pageantry and the sense that you get this in all kind of pageanty type movies where it being someone's year.
Yeah.
You know?
It's Scott's year.
It's Scott's year. And like this thing of, you know, you've paid your dues.
Yep.
You're an attractive next successor of this generation to keep this thing alive. And like, really the best characters are all the older characters.
Oh, absolutely.
Really. They're the ones you're most interested in. Like, and just, it's a bit like, you know, Gavin and Stacey, where like Gavin and Stacey are very bland characters, but they are the tent poles that are holding up the circus.
Yes.
And this thing of like, we need new young couples who are like going to be the face of the next generation so we can continue to make money off of
who are going to run these dance schools and do the home videos and the books and
and no one will ever get rich enough to even do this full time.
No, this cannot be your job. Like, this is never going to be your job, but it will earn you enough to keep this alive and keep it going.
And that is so good to me. Yeah. It's so fast. And I've been dancing around it. but the movie that I compare this to most in my heart, not Muriel's Wedding, not Priscilla, but Babe.
But Babe. You texted me this yesterday. Yeah. I was like, I cannot wait to hear this.
So Babe, another great Australian movie.
But
people don't really think of as an Australian movie, I think
because
the accents aren't there.
Well, they also very deliberately didn't set it anywhere specific. So everyone uses their own accent. So Magda Szubanski, who is incredible in Kath and Kim as well, like an icon of Australian culture, is very Australian.
Yeah.
And James Cromwell is obviously British and English, and they all use their own accents. They do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a green and pleasant land.
Yes.
The book is set in England, but the film is definitely not specifically England.
And but it's got an Australian director.
Yes. And it was filmed in Australia. It's a big Australian success story.
And the only sort of indication that you have that it's an Australian movie is that it's Summer at Christmas.
Yes.
Which I always found so odd when I was a child.
And I guess I hadn't actually thought about it until now.
Yeah.
It hadn't even occurred to me that was a
thing.
Yeah,
it's like blue skies when they're putting up that tree.
Oh, yeah, no, totally, of course.
Yeah. So everyone will kind of, who only dimly remembers Babe, I mean, and doesn't watch it twice a year as I do, By the way, if anyone wants to hear me talk about Babe for a long time on the You Are Good podcast,
stop.
I had a great
You've
time.
You've done a whole time.
Oh, I've done a whole
thing. Obviously, yeah. You're listening.
So it is a movie that everyone will remember as being, yeah, farm. Yeah, pig.
Farm, pig.
But the infrastructure of the plot is based around what seems to me like a very Australian thing of like committees and contests and fairs, and we do things a certain way here. So Farmer Hoggett's wife, she is like, she's won every prize in the county for her jams and her squashes and her her cat. And
yes,
like,
there's
nothing in her life that she hasn't turned into a prize to a point that even her husband, the how he gets like Babe off the hook for Christmas dinner is by saying that like he's getting fat haunches and next year
fat haunches. He could be your prize pig next year.
He could be a prize pig, and she's like, okay, you know. And then it's this funny parallel because at the very end you get like this whole rush to the final competition thing for the sheepdog trials, which again, a bizarre hobby that is mental. But like, the more mental a hobby is, the more rigid it becomes,
yes,
because
totally.
The people in control of it are so aware of how mental it looks. So therefore, they heap more formality on top of it. And like, you know, like Fran is Babe. Babe is Fran. It's like everyone like hushed silence being like, oh my God, what are you doing?
Nobody's
this is an insult
this
to this community that we have beat the snakes to build.
We built our buildings and now we do this inside these buildings.
Exactly. And you are ruining it.
You're ruining it for all of us.
Yeah, and it even has this sort of thing of like the sort of over ambitious kind of like manic woman obsessed with prizes and opportunity, and sort of like the hushed kind of insular
calmness
of the henpecked husband, but who inside there is an enormous human being who just wants to express themselves.
Yes,
really. There's a lot of
there's a lot of parallels.
If only that was on my leaving cert.
That would be amazing.
It's all just so good.
It is so good, and I think it's so good because it is so many things at once.
Yeah.
Like, it does have that underdog against the establishment story. It's sort of not quite, but kind of like structurally a sports film.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a sporting, you know, film that celebrates somebody's hard graft and gets them to the competition, you know, and in a cool running style gets them to have a great time and win the respect of everybody, but not crucially actually win. But it's also a rom-com. Like, this, the structure of it, the beats of it are very much a rom-com. And it's less a rom-com between sort of Scott and Fran as much as Scott and dancing with Fran.
Yes.
Like, their romance is lovely and sweet and moving and, you know, all of those things. But actually, it's not the key of the story here. The key is them being able to dance his steps together.
Yes, or their steps together.
And their steps, the fact that they become her
steps.
And
they teach one another.
Because they teach one another and she teaches, you know, the first moment where she's like trying to interject with a step that she's come up with.
Yeah.
And he's just talking over, and then she just dances around him and like bashes the floor with her great shoes around him. And he looks at her and he's like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
What is that? What are we doing? And realizes he's found somebody who can, again, show him something he hasn't seen before. Show him something outside of the establishment, the outside of the thing he's been doing since he was 6 years old.
Yeah.
That he doesn't understand or where this is coming from in himself. Like, these steps are just a thing that he feels.
We never get a motive for Scott.
No.
He's just bored.
He's been doing this one thing and his soul, his spirit, his dancing self wants to dance differently. And it's not until he meets her family that he's kind of given a way to understand it and appreciate it and even like codify it in ways to like find a way to learn new steps that feel like his steps.
Yeah, and it's such a... It's so hard for anything like... Any form of personal expression that is essentially ancient and illogical kind of thing. We don't really know why we sing. We don't really know why we dance, except that every human being who's ever lived has felt alive while doing it.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like the in dialogue, we try and get all these expressions for how dancing makes a person feel or when it should be good, like listening to your heart and feeling it in your heart. And, you know, Grandma Fran is really going out of her way to push that home. And like, and that really means nothing because it's such an ineffable and hard to describe concept, you know, of like just what is feeling it and what is rigidity and what makes your heart sing. And like, it's just something that has to be communicated through cinematography and external shots.
Yes. of the freedom of them dancing outside.
Yeah.
Of them like breaking out of the dance studio and going to be somewhere else where they're not surrounded by mirrors. They're not surrounded by like, is your arm in the right place? Is the angle correct? You can see yourself every single place you look. And instead they're on a roof or they're on the back deck or they're somewhere else and they're walking home and they can dance without looking at themselves and judging themselves. They can just dance how they feel.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so nice.
So nice.
So nice.
It's
such a good film.
Everything about it is just good.
So good.
And like, it's just, it's dirty dancing for freaks.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, for real, like freaks. Nerds and losers.
For nerds and losers. Yeah. Because it's like.
Because it's sexy, but it's not sexy. It's not like dirty dancing sexy where there's a sort of like real clarity to what this is. But every time they look at each other, it's sexy. But it's just nerdy sexy.
It's nerd sex.
Yeah.
It really is. And like, I think there's like a huge tradition within this kind of trope.
Yes.
Of like the character who is within a community where everyone does one thing one way. But this character is like, no, I can't. I not only do I not want to, I simply can't because of every instinct in my body. And that's like so ripe for a queer allegory, right?
Oh, massively.
And like, I feel like this movie plays with that in such an intense and brilliant way.
Yeah.
Of like the mockumentary at the very beginning of his mother being like, did I fail
him as a
mother?
Did I fail him as a mother? And it is perfect. It's Baz Luhrmann's talked about it and he's gone, it's not a film about ballroom dancing. It's a film about oppression. Like the story is one of oppression and is of being oppressed by a sort of, he speaks very generally about oppression, but I think there is something definitely in the being oppressed by a very conservative, very ruled and mannered, sort of Anglo-Saxon influenced version of Australian man. Uh-huh. Sort of very strong patriarchy, very strong sense of right and wrong and everybody's place in the world and where people should fit. And that works for ballroom dancing. It works for the fact, you know, all of the high ups in the ballroom dancing scene and community are all men.
Yes.
They're all men who are sort of these, this is how we're going to run this. This is what it's going to look like. Like Barry Fife is such an icon of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so to have somebody in that where they are fighting against being able to conform in the way that they should conform is definitely always going to feel a bit queer.
And it's also the thing that the constant reiterating of the word flashy and crowd-pleasing.
Crowd-pleasing, flashy. Yeah, Scott's moves being sort of wrong because of being crowd-pleasing, of being something that's going to seem appealing, actually. That people are going to look at and go, oh, how fun, how cool. But
which
now
is
you're not fitting.
Every right-wing panic about any kind of queer identity ever. It's like, well, if we make
appealing.
Either gay life or trans life look appealing,
then
they'll all be gay.
They'll all be gay. Imagine if you allowed drag queens to read at libraries, all children would be gay because that looks like fun.
They can't think it's fun.
It's a really terrible time.
You from the you who knows nothing about ballroom dancing
Indeed.
May think from the outside it looks like a fun life, but you'll see. It's...
You will see.
God, people are bonkers, aren't they?
Yeah, but it really works as that, and it you know, as a story, it feels like a very small, very specific story about this one community, and that is very true, all of it. Mm-hmm. But I think there is something in my. Like, my relationship with Australia is I moved away when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
So a long, long time before I came out. And I didn't spend my teenage years being kind of closeted or feeling particularly oppressed. But it's only looking back that I can recognize the oppression of being in a Catholic girls' school where mm-hmm. there was a very specific version of life that I was supposed to be aspiring to, one which I have failed to achieve by being gay and by being unmarried and by not having children yet. Might, you know, all of these things are open, but the sort of picture of what that will look like is not the picture that I was raised in my community to understand would be my future. And yeah, so I cannot speak to the experience of being gay in Australia. Interestingly, I wasn't. You know, looking back on it, it's not like I'm sort of remembering the oppression. It's only really in hindsight that I can see why it took me so long to come out, why that, you know, why the way my life has been shaped has, you know, has been really impacted by where I grew up, and in a lovely way too. I grew up in a really nice community, in a really nice city. I went to the beach, we climbed mountains, we had a great time, we spent, you know, endless nights at having barbecues. It was a great childhood and a great time to be alive in Australia, but it's also definitely a time where there was a very specific view of what we'd all grow up to be. And I think that I don't live there anymore, but my understanding from conversations with friends and with people and people who've moved back and all of that is that that does feel different now. I think the 90s was a time when it felt very much like Australia was ruled by a very specific vision of what Australia looks like and should be. And that was, I think that that is a really tangible reaction against a wave of post-war migration into Australia that shifted what communities looked like and who communities were, that sort of there are a couple of big waves of immigration into Australia at various points throughout the past sort of 250 years that is post sort of the when Indigenous Australians were the people who lived in Australia. So those waves of migration changed the way that communities operated and what you could eat and do and see and who you could talk to and all of those things in ways that
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
It has always felt great to me, but I appreciate that if you are a white descended Anglo-Saxon person who came from convicts or from Irish famine boats or from anything else and has been in Australia for some 200 years or whatever it was by that point, that it is different. And I say that with love for difference, but recognizing that a lot of the mentality of that time came out of feeling an unsettling and like you weren't in control of that difference.
And that's so fascinating to me. And do you think that is why in so much Australian film and TV, like I'm thinking of like Kath and Kim or whatever, it does, again, to sort of reference this John Waters sense of like the heightened ridiculousness of trying to control anything.
Yeah, I think that like, you know, I always hesitate to speak for a country that I no longer live in. But
I understand. I feel the same way about Ireland, where I haven't lived full time since I was 21 either, you know?
Exactly. I think it's a very similar, like, here are my feelings rather than here is my thesis.
Yes. You know? Which is very much this podcast.
This podcast. Yeah. But yes. But yeah, I do feel that. I do feel like there is a real sense of, so one of my favorite books in Australia from Australia is Picnic at Hanging Rock, which came out in the late 50s.
I feel like I'm familiar with the aesthetic, but I've never read it.
I think that that is a really common vibe.
Yeah.
Is that it's a Peter Weir film. No, it's a... Oh, damn it. It's not Peter Weir. That's Heavenly Creatures. It's somebody. It's a great film, and I think it had a very clear aesthetic and a very clear visual sense, which is hot rock girls in white dresses.
Yes, that's what I'm imagining. Yeah. Yes.
And the book is that too, but only for the first chapter. So the book is essentially a girls' school created in the sort of outside of Melbourne, where Hanging Rock literally is in real life. Mm-hmm. So about an hour from there, it is a school set up by an English woman who is coming to Australia and wants to have a school for girls of, you know, of colonizers, essentially. So, you know, it's set in 1901, in the year that Australia became a federation, so became a country. And they go off on a picnic to Hanging Rock, and some of the girls disappear. Some of the girls wander up the rock and vanish.
Oh.
And they return to school, and it's like one of the teachers has vanished, some of these girls have vanished, and it's like, where have they gone? And the whole book is just the community's reaction to this disappearance. And it is very much reckoning with whether you can fit an English sensibility into a country that doesn't have an English sensibility about it.
That's fascinating.
It doesn't physically feel like England.
Yeah.
So how could we possibly hope to create England down under? Like, how could that be true?
It's not even so much cramming a square peg into a round hole. It's throwing tiny squares into a huge hole.
Yes.
And watching them disappear into blackness
because they cannot hope to fill the same space and support themselves.
And I really want to read that.
It's fantastic. I genuinely, I think you'd really enjoy it.
And yeah, read it and you can come back and we can talk about
it. Perfect. Yeah. And the writing period of it is bananas. Like the writer, Joan Lindsay, when she was writing it, she essentially woke up from a fever dream and had a mad 4 weeks and just wrote this novel.
Okay.
Like in a haze
weirdness.
Yeah. So I think that same sensibility of like, what does it look like to try and control a world that is uncontrollable and that we are still reckoning with and trying to understand? That's, you know, it's the same feeling about Priscilla, like drag queens in the desert. It's like, how do we fit here? What version of this makes sense? How do we occupy this space? How do we look
How do we find meaning in a world that would just like consume us?
Yes,
do you know what I mean?
Totally. And I think we were, all of these 90s films as well, is pre The Apology, which is a big moment in Australian history of the government essentially making a public apology to Indigenous Australians for the brutal actions of colonialism, of essentially coming to a country going, I mean, it's pretty empty. We could take it.
It's empty-ish.
And then doing it. And then spending the next 200 years and continuing oppressing the people who were here in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, and in ways that I think have been quite well documented, but I always wonder how well documented outside of Australia in terms of Stolen Generations, in terms of...
I would say my knowledge of it is completely confined to the film Rabbit Proof Fence.
Yeah, I would. I think that film did a lot of heavy lifting in terms of the international perception of that as a sort of a history. Mm-hmm. But there are ongoing things, you know, in communities in Australia, in ongoing interventions, ongoing oppressions, ongoing sort of... I think it's still a history that we as a country are reckoning with and trying to work out what it looks like to have done this. Mm. But for our ancestors to have done this, my ancestors are convicts, so to have done this, all of us, and for it to sort of... to try and work out what to do now, how to live with that, how to engage with that, in the same way that, you know, American communities are trying to do with Indigenous communities in America and in Canada and in, you know, everywhere else where white people showed up from Europe and went, oh, we're going to put a flag here and own this.
But with the added complication of not everybody who came to Australia came by choice.
Indeed.
You know?
Yeah.
It is a fascinating country. And
I am
psyched
You're
to go
gonna
there.
You're going to have an amazing time.
And I'm also psyched to have so many Australians who are into this podcast.
This is a really nice thing about it.
Yeah.
It's going to be so nice for you. Every time I do an episode with you, we have done a handful now,
yeah,
I get such nice messages from like people I went to school with, people I went to university with, people who are just Australian and follow me, mm-hmm, who are like, I can't believe you're on Caroline's podcast. This is so amazing.
I can't wait.
It's really nice. I think there's a really passionate, interested readership, listenership.
I want to talk a little bit about the dressing of the spaces.
Oh my gosh.
And the dressing of the people.
I just looked at my notes and I was like, can we please talk about the glamour?
The glamour.
The glamour. The diamantes. The fringes. And I mean like on dresses, but also that are 10 centimetres high off people's foreheads.
The...
like
just the kind of the sort of a hairspray to oblivion
fan
almost like
fringe.
A peacock sort
it's
of
so mad,
it's so nuts.
Yeah, I mean, so it's all Catherine Martin, who is Baz Luhrmann's wife, mm-hmm, who he met at university, I think, and that they or met like doing shows at university, and he'd been working with her for a little bit by this point because she did a musical at Sydney Opera House with him, and she had done mm-hmm theatre with him by this point and had done other stuff, but this was their first like film together, because his first film obviously, and she's done every one of his films since, and she is the Australian with the most Academy Awards, the like most Academy awarded Australian ever, because she's just amazing. The design is so specific, so beautifully done, so well realised. And it is mad to see all of these sort of working and middle class people in these extraordinary outfits that must cost enormous amounts of money to like or time to make and prepare and do and have.
Well, that's what's so wonderful is that like it gives such a great sense of like these people eat, sleep and breathe this.
Yes.
And they make a living doing something. It doesn't matter what, because their soul isn't there.
Yeah.
But it's like their...
Everything is towards this.
Everything's towards this. There's no scene where like Scott's family are eating together. It is always like her hemming a child's costume.
Yeah.
It's like always doing something to contribute towards this ballroom thing.
He comes home at 2 a.m, there's chops in the fridge, and that's the only mention we get of anybody having any food at all.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one scene where the grandmother is frying some kind of dumpling.
Yep. Perfect.
But yeah, we don't need food. We just need dance.
Every time I see you, you've got pins in your mouths and you're preparing a new outfit, a new costume.
It's so fascinating to me, family, when I meet families, because I come from a family of... whatever the opposite of a joiner is.
Sure.
Like, there was never anyone in my family, all the six of us, who was like really into
a thing.
Like, my parents played some golf and tennis, but mostly, you know, so pretty social kind of thing. None of my siblings, none of us were really that into something. It would always get to a point where we'd do Saturday morning drama or a bit of football or a bit of this, and it would get to a point where it's like, I'm only going to go so far with this. And then we're just real quitters. And so whenever you get these families who like they're so dedicated, mm-hmm, which is interesting because I just got married. You were there.
Yes, I was there.
My husband, which is fun to say, I am marrying into a family of committees and joiners.
Interesting.
So my Gavin's parents are, they're on the bowls team. They've historically been a member of a motorcycling club, darts. It's kind of like there's nothing that they have ever done that they didn't then become the treasurer of.
Yes. I really know the vibe. I am from a family of joiners.
Yeah. And I kind of envy it in a way. Because it feels like something very noble about handing yourself over to a community in such a full-throated, wholehearted and very practical way.
Yes.
Because I feel like everything in my life personally is about the furthering of me in my life. Like podcasting, extremely egotistical and self-centered profession, novels, the pursuit of the self and the understanding of the self. And so I've never felt like I've been within a club or a group of any kind. And I envy it. But I also don't know how to park myself in order to do it.
Yeah.
And that really brought things up for me in this movie.
Yeah. I think there's a sense in this film as well of the community is so specific in its hierarchy and clearly delineated of like who's important, who's mm-hmm. not important. There's a obvious thing of like Fran's been doing this for 2 years and she doesn't have a partner yet.
Yeah. That's and for a beginner a to even hope, to even, yes. to even like approach an open amateur.
Yeah. For a beginner to approach
Scott is
an
so
open
horrified.
Amateur.
He's like so sick of the regiments of his own yeah. world. And he's like, I can't believe.
I cannot fathom Fran being like, I could dance with you.
Yeah. And also I could tell you how to dance.
Yes. I want to dance your steps. I think you're good. And actually I've got some ideas.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So good.
But I do think that inside, you know, outside of that hierarchy and structure and all of those things, is also like, I can imagine that lots of those costumes are shared or handed down
yeah.
or altered given within and, the community, yeah. altered for somebody new. Because I think you're right. There is a real sense of like a community and a sense of all of these people joining this thing and then doing it together. And yeah. even though there's a lot of petty, like, well, maybe not petty, but infighting and sort of, valuing of some people over others and the very specific hierarchy, there is also, I think, a real sense of community spirit and generosity and the way that everybody cheers for each other mm. when they are performing. And even though everybody knows it's Scott's year, they are still cheering for everybody else. They're still like yeah. a real group who've come on this day to show off their dancers, their team. You know, against everybody else's team.
Yeah.
And that's really nice and fun.
It is
that's a really,
really
nice vibe. And I grew up in a family of, my sister and I were real joiners at school. We're actually like less so now. Mm. I think I've made my hobby having friends, which is not the same as having a hobby.
It is. If you were to read Elizabeth Day's new book, it is a hobby.
There we go.
And
okay.
Yeah, it is also my hobby.
Yeah. I think it's a really, it is what I spend my time doing. It's, yeah. But when I was a kid, I'm going to say this with love for anybody who went to my school and is listening to this, but I didn't really have any proper friends until maybe year 11. Like I had friends in primary school, but I went to secondary school and felt very not quite part of a group, a specific mm-hmm. group. So I spent every lunchtime, or little lunch, as we call it, morning tea, mm-hmm. Doing a club. So I did Interact, I did Amnesty, I did choir, I did football, I did basketball, I did swimming, I did, you know, I had so many clubs and I was always a part of a club. And during my primary school years, my mum had been treasurer of the parents and PTA, like the Parents and Friends mm-hmm. Association, or Parents and Teachers. And so organised the fete and, you know, did all yes. of these things. So like on a weekend, we'd be at school organising this thing, making sure this thing could happen. And it just never occurred to me that there could be another way of engaging with school or with life in a school. Yeah. So I did the musical. I was in three different choirs. I had, you know, I was part of the soccer team. I was all of those things. And so I had lots of different places to put my energy and my time. Mm-hmm. And it meant that, yeah, we did a lot of sewing of costumes and, you know, preparing of bits for whatever Lucy and I were doing that weekend, like for whatever activity we'd signed ourselves up for.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really great training of the soul, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it was really good for me.
Right? And I look at you and me because we know each other very well.
Yeah.
And there are things in your character that I think that came from that world of sewing somebody else's costume
yeah.
that I don't have. And I'm not saying that I'm inherently selfish and you're inherently selfless, but I'm kind of saying that.
I think I'm a bit selfish, but in a way that I have had to learn. I think my selflessness is something that I have fought against because it felt like the right answer to be selfless. And part of being
smother,
in my 30s yeah, was yeah. getting to a point of going, it's okay to say no, to have boundaries, and people respect that. And it's really important to put your time, attention, and care where you want to put it. Because you cannot blanket help everyone and help everything. You need to find a focus and find a thing and find the time that you want to commit to those things, because otherwise you're going to burn out. You know,
I'm glad you learned that.
Yeah, it was a really hard lesson, but I think it was a really good lesson to learn. And I'm much better at focusing on, and I'm a much better friend for it. Like I'm a much better dedicator of time now because I'm not trying to blanket just say yes to everyone and everything all the time.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
But I'm also glad that like, as cynical as we could be about the characters in this movie who are obsessed with their little community.
Yeah.
The joys of that.
The joys of that.
Yeah.
They're real tangible joys. You know, when stuff's going well, when they think it's going to be amazing, when like Tina Sparkle comes when Tina Sparkle comes and wants to maybe dance with Scott.
Yeah.
The like investment of the community in that moment.
The lightness that comes over all those characters.
The fact that like nobody questions that she would be Scott's.
Yeah.
Like that nobody else in the club is like, oh, I wish she was dancing with me. It's just like we need to get a new partner for our guy whose year it is and she's the girl and it's going to happen and it's going to be amazing. Like they are all so behind it.
Yeah. And
that's so nice.
Yeah, obviously it's set up as this huge disappointment for Fran.
Of course.
But it's like the lightness of it feels real and the hope feels real.
Yeah.
I feel like we haven't spoken enough about Fran and her makeover, which I feel like is the least problematic makeover in all of cinema.
I think it's really well tastefully done.
Yeah.
To be like this quite awkward, like late teens girl who doesn't, you know, who needs maybe a little help in figuring out what makeup goes on her face if she wants to wear makeup, who works out how to wear a scoop neck, who figures out a midriff. You know, she just gets like a really, it's not like one scene where a prettier character sits there and goes, this is how we're going to dress you from now on. Here you are.
But it makes fun of that trope.
Yeah, totally.
By having Shirley, insane makeup on her.
Yeah, this blue and pink, I think it's you.
I think it's you. And always like flogging apricot scrub at her, which I wince every time
I hear. Me too. I'm like, don't put apricot scrub on that face.
Anything but apricot scrub. She can't. It's too sensitive.
What a time though. We were all told that that's what we had to do.
Oh my, that was like the first skincare I ever engaged in. St. Ives.
Yeah, St. Ives. A big fucking tube
big
of St. Ives.
Big glob beige.
Glob of like sand to rub into your face.
For all faces.
Oh, all faces. Yeah. Indiscriminately, all faces.
Awful. But it's...
And that's laughed at. And instead she gets to like quietly just find confidence and poise and sort of, you know, a confidence and a security in her body as well. Like she just holds herself differently. She starts walking differently and standing differently.
Yes. It's such from the inside out.
Yeah.
Performance, which I think she is the very clearly stronger actor of the two.
Oh, definitely. So she is an actor and not a dancer, and
he's a dancer, not an actor, which I actually think is lovely.
Me too. I think it works really well.
It works really, really well.
Yeah.
In the same way, I think it worked for Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey.
Definitely.
In that Patrick Swayze, like, I'm sorry. People love that man, and I love them for loving him.
Yeah.
But not an actor, really. I don't think, like, he's not amazing. You know, he's dreamy and lovely, but he's not amazing. But yeah, to have, because it really feels like the heart of all dance movies is about two people teaching each other how to do something new. That's kind of always it.
Yes.
And it's like, so it feels like one
from
person.
From Say the Last Dance to Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's always like, come and show me your steps.
Yeah.
Come and show me
and
new
so to
thing.
Have one really strong dramatic actor and one really strong dancer feels so harmonious on screen.
And she'd been doing it, she did it on stage as well. So when it was a play, she did it on stage. And Paul Mercurio, who is Scott, was new. So he was like brought on for the film.
Yeah.
But she'd been doing it for ages. Like Fran was her role, like her
thing. Yes. And it was quite difficult casting her, right?
Because they were like, we want a name as well. Like,
yeah.
We want either a name or we want a dancer. And she's not really either.
Yeah.
And he fought for her and made it happen. And it's just really lovely that she gets to be that woman. She is her. I really believe her in it.
Yeah. Oh, I believe her so much. And maybe it's because we believe both of them so much. But even though the Paul Mercurio isn't a fabulous actor, I believe him so deeply.
Oh, yeah. I believe his like passion for it.
Because
and I believe his energy.
I believe that's what 18-year-old boys who've been trained to do one thing and have probably been getting laid since they were 14. I believe that's what they're like.
Yeah.
They're just like indignant all the time and sort of distracted.
And that first scene where the dance studio clears out and he stays and dances on his own.
Yeah.
I'm like, I buy this so much.
I buy it so much.
I buy you looking at your grown-up man's body that you probably came into relatively recently trying to figure out how it moves
Yeah.
And like trying to figure out the limits of it and what you can do with it and how exciting that is and how new that is and how you don't just want to be told to stand up straight, hold your arm
and
at a
smile
93
and
angle
be rigid.
And smile.
Yeah.
Like that your body can do this stuff now and you want to figure it out. I buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he seems like a character who has seen Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's really important that watching it yesterday, Dirty Dancing came back and came up in the corner as the credits closed. Of like, we're going to start playing this next, and I was like, of course you are, unless you intervene, we are sending you straight to Dirty Dancing. And it is this like they are definitely in conversation with each other.
Yeah,
these films have a shared language, and I think this film is telling a different story, and it is very specifically
I think Dirty Dancing is a film about society and Strictly Ballroom is a film about community.
Yeah,
where
I think that's nice.
It's like, yeah, that is nice.
Yeah.
it's so much, even though both of them have a sort of like a, oh, this person's from this place and this person's from this place and one has rules and one has freedom kind of thing. It really feels like, we did an episode on Dirty Dancing recently and I couldn't help.
Oh, Curtis Sittenfeld.
Yeah.
So good.
What a get. I know. I was amazed.
I know.
Was like, are you sure? it really feeling like a dance musical version of The Bell Jar.
Yeah.
Because it feels so much about womanhood in the early
60s. About that summer that they executed the
Rosenbergs. Yeah. And I didn't know what I was
doing in New York.
And that this is like, Dirty Dancing is a movie about society pushing in on a hermetically sealed world, and like it's like, oh, the sort of this Catskills resort that is frequented by mostly a Jewish clientele, about like how we're reaching a point where anti-Semitism has relaxed enough so it doesn't need to be that Jewish people have to be in their own resorts, and that's a good thing, but also we lose this,
also this community,
we
and
lose
this
that, you know,
part of society and this place for people, and
right, so yeah. It's this outside world is pushing in and infiltrating this space, whereas like it feels the reverse in Strictly.
I just think there's so little sense of the outside world.
Yeah,
really, like everyone, instead of being sort of outsiders who are looking in and encroaching or anything like that, the community just expands to include anyone who wants to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, it expands to include Fran's dad and Fran's grandma. Like,
yes.
It's like, okay, here, we'll open up this community to these two people. They will be dancing with other people at the end.
Yeah.
But we don't see a world outside of this little community.
Yeah.
We don't have a sense of like anybody else's world. I think there's not even clarity of like, it's not even definitely defined what city we're in.
No.
It's
Do you have a guess?
It was filmed in Sydney, apart from the final scene, which is filmed at like the Melbourne Entertainment and Sports Arena or Space or something. And so in my head it's Sydney because it's filmed in Sydney, but also like if you said to me like, no, Baz Luhrmann was very clear that it was a Melbourne thing, I'd be like, yeah, sure.
Sure, fine.
It does not feel like Brisbane, where I grew up, just like in terms of the small bits of geography that we see when we go outside. But I really buy it being Sydney or Melbourne.
I just love that final scene. Just all dance movies basically make it or break it based on the final dance,
yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
If you can't nail that, the movie is done, you know? And I really think this fucking shits on Dirty Dancing's final dance scene.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, obviously, we all know the lift and we love the lift.
Yeah, the
and
lift
all
is
that.
Amazing. It's all beautiful. But this, you know, I think there's something magical about the end of Dirty Dancing. It's really lovely. It's really, you know, it's really great. But the real moment is like, nobody puts baby in a corner. I'm going to walk over to your family. I'm going to talk to them. And that's the moment of like, we are doing this thing.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the moment of doing the thing is like, okay, we're dancing.
Okay.
I'm not talking about it. We're not doing anything. It's Doug coming out and clapping.
Oh.
It's them coming on and dancing their steps with her in this incredible flamenco dress, and then the music being pulled, them being disqualified, the music being pulled, and then the slow clap beginning, and them just getting to finish their dance and their steps, and then everybody coming out to join them. Like, it's beautiful. And that dance is so beautiful.
It's so beautiful.
It's so hot. It's so, like, impressive technically, like, to watch. It's so, like, stunning watching them doing it. But it's their chemistry while doing it is so good.
It's so good.
It's just such a nice dance.
And I think what really helps it as well is because there's so much energy and verve going, pushing and pushing and pushing towards the final dance. That last act, it just goes off.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's like we get Tina Sparkle entering and leaving. And it's this lovely thing where it's like, we never see Scott letting Fran down.
Yes.
We go
straight to the competition. It's mad. Yeah, structurally, it's so good.
It's really brave, actually. Yeah. And it's just like, it's very like, you know what happens.
You know what happens. Like, they make her contact over the thing. She's now dancing again with a woman. She's in her, like, old dress.
Yeah.
And
he's dancing with Tina Sparkle.
He's dancing with Tina Sparkle because, of course.
A little commotion for Tina Sparkle.
A little commotion for Tina Sparkle. That woman.
Not only is she, like, of course you'd be like, oh, of course she's the star. Of course, we can't believe that Tina Sparkle is here. But she also, her comedic performance, I think is, for what
so
tiny
good.
We get, it's
yeah.
so good.
She has so little that she's allowed to do apart from, like, stand there and look amazing like Tina Sparkle.
Yeah.
But every line she has, she's just on point. She's so good.
And there's something very, like, decent about her as well. We know that she's not, that's the thing when people, I heard of a famous person I know.
Sure.
It was Lauren Laverne.
Great.
I used to work for her. I remember her saying that, like, the most famous people you ever met tend to be really lovely. It's people who haven't gotten what they want from fame.
Who are still, like,
who are actually awful to be with.
Yeah.
People
and
who,
she's already top of her game.
Yeah,
she's
wanted
by everybody. And she's in a position of being able to be like, Scott seems good. He seems like a good dancer. This seems like a good troupe.
Yeah,
like, she's potentially excited to dance with him.
And they just keep saying Fran around her.
No.
And she's like, Fran, the girl who fell.
Fran.
So good.
But yeah, that final act of, like, Doug as well, of Scott's dad, suddenly
sort of bend your ear for a moment.
Yeah,
bend
your ear for a tick. But then him yelling as Scott's trying to head on, like, there's something you must know.
About the past.
It's such a deranged, like, way of introducing that information. Yeah. It becomes so heightened and so full on. And that the energy leading up to that final dance, you're so right, is just like piling on top of each other and top of each other and top of each other. It's like everything is happening. Like, Barry Fife is fixing it. You know, you've got your best friends, like, figuring out that it's being fixed.
Yeah.
And then rushing to tell Les, like, everything is being found out bit by bit by bit in the space of about 3 minutes.
It's so and also the part, so they all agree that, like, Scott must know the dark, hideous,
the dark,
and the way
history.
It's played, it's like someone was beaten to death with a shovel.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
the ominousness of it. It's like, but then Barry Fife relays his version of events to Scott in order to get him to dance with Tina and dump
Fran. What is definitely the most bizarre sequence in the entire film.
And maybe in all of film.
In all of film. Because
I love it.
Me too. It's played so like it would be played on stage.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm like, I so see the trajectory of this film from its stage version.
Yeah.
Which started as like a 30-minute devised piece at his drama school and then ended up on stage at various points as like expanded pieces.
And then
pieces.
10 years later
and,
became a movie.
Like it took a real journey to get there. But that piece of like both of them not being played by younger actors, just in different makeup, different body bits.
And I know the whole purpose of the red curtain trilogy is that viewing the world through cinematic tropes, very much reminding the viewer that you are not watching real life, you are watching how real life is understood by people who are raised on films.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's exactly
raised
what
by
he
films
means.
Or, yeah, in storytelling and like, because that's, it's, you know, Christian going to Paris and being like, I wanted the story to happen to
exactly.
me.
People being aware of the stories they've been raised on and the, because I think that is what we are, Baz is very, you know, interested in, like.
Yeah.
Because we've all been shown versions
myth and
of
storytelling.
Life.
Like, even, we're going to bring them up, but Australia, Great Gatsby, Elvis are all like myth and storytelling.
Yes.
Like, he continues to make films about how we live and tell stories and what impact that has on the people who are trying to live tangible lives.
Yeah.
if you are
that's true
obsessed with storytelling and myth.
Yeah, it's very like I don't think anyone loves any of those movies. I really didn't like the Elvis movie.
Me neither.
I really didn't like The Great Gatsby, and I have not seen Australia.
It's not good.
Okay.
It's just...
I keep waiting for somebody to call it an underloved classic.
It's
but
really not.
It's correctly it's, loved.
What
it's
I
not
would
at
say
all.
Is do not... It's like the opposite of this podcast. It's the like...
Oh.
It did really well financially. Yeah. It's like one of the most successful movies ever from Made in Australia.
Okay.
Did really well, weirdly, in Europe, but not in England. So yeah. it did well, like in translation, and in lots of countries on the continent, and it did really well in Australia.
Uh-huh.
But it's like bloated, and it's long, and I know what it's trying to do, and it's actually like beautiful in moments, but uh-huh. in terms of a piece of storytelling, it's not something I've ever thought about since.
Oh,
like whereas
no.
I think about Strictly Ballroom all the time, I think about Moulin Rouge all the time.
Yeah, but if we go back to so that being the purpose of the red carpet. Sorry, I keep saying my carpet.
Red curtain trilogy.
And it being how people understand their lives through the cinema that they were raised on. It's like Barry Fife telling his story, which and the way it's staged is like silent actor
silent film actor makeup, yeah.
But also sort of like 1960s beach movies.
Yeah.
And also bad end of the pier kind of theatre, all smashed
very
on
vaudeville.
Top of each other. Very vaudeville. And like, you know, it's just, I don't know, the way he narrates it, it's so, I love it.
Yeah, it's mad. It's so...
It's so ghoulish.
It is really ghoulish. It's really, and it's really interesting that it's a lie.
Yeah.
Like, it of course it's a lie. Of course it's not the real story. And the way that it's told is very much like Doug is almost performing against his will. Like he's performing a version of his life that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And I think that feels very truthful to what we actually find out in the final dying moments is the truth.
Which is like, again, so undramatic.
It doesn't matter.
So,
Shirley danced with Les.
Shirley danced with Les.
At the Pan Pacific Grand Prix.
Because Barry Fife told her to.
Because Barry Fife didn't want her and Doug to win. Because Barry Fife wanted to win.
Yes.
So he orchestrated it that Les would dance with Shirley, that Doug would not have a partner, and that he, Barry Fife, would win and therefore set himself up for this generation of
VHS tapes.
VHS tapes. That is it.
Great.
Yeah. And that has had an impact on Doug and Shirley's marriage.
Marriage.
Since then. Like, that is the untold story here. Like the lack of detail we have about the impact that that's had on their marriage, and yet the way in which it definitely seeps into every moment that they're on screen together is amazing.
Oh my God. The bit, I think that the most emotional part of the whole movie for me is when Love Is in the Air comes on.
Oh, don't even.
It is the best piece of hand acting since 2005's Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, yeah. It's the obsession. If it was made now, the girls online would be absolutely clipping it and just being like, this.
But it's like Doug, them sort of like finally airing what has destroyed this marriage, which is that he said you should have been with me for richer or poorer or whatever. And her being like, we wouldn't have won. It's like, you didn't win. And he's like, yeah, your fault. It's like they are dying in the embers of this dream. And he just like, they've aired it now. It's out there.
Yeah.
They've never said it. And he just reaches for her.
Reaches for her.
And it's like, because she's this insane character who's like always has this smile painted on her face.
Yeah.
It's like, I've got my happy face on today.
Happy face.
And she's just does this little kind of crumpled sort of like half frown, half smile. And she just like offers her hand up
as if
like, she's like, I'm willing to try this marriage again.
Yeah, I can try this.
We can start again.
We can and we will be more honest this time.
Yeah.
We will have had this conversation that's been boiling under. And for him, like, she kept running this dance. Like, she's there every day. This is
and he's there every day.
He's there every day, like, downstairs with his records and his memories. Like, it has not been a thing that they don't talk about that doesn't really impact on them. It lives in them every day. This betrayal that neither of them really understand.
No.
Or they understand wrongly.
Because they haven't talked about it. Because of gender.
Because you don't talk about things.
Yeah. I remember I heard this inspirational speaker once, who I don't rate, but she really hit, sometimes they hit sure. on something once. But she said, you know, men are taught to live in their bodies and women are taught to live in their minds, and then we expect them to live together. And I just think that's very real.
That is very real.
We keep missing each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that is why lesbians be crazy. Two people in their minds all the time.
Oh no, it's 3D chess and it's in space.
It's in space.
Oh wow. Oh, do you have anything else to say?
I'm just going to look at my notes.
Okay.
I've just written down a lot of quotes.
The one big scene we haven't spoken about is the perhaps scene.
Mm.
And I have nothing specific to say other than I just find it so beautiful.
Yeah.
And when I had a Bebo account, which Bebo was the big thing in Ireland, MySpace never hit, but you could embed a video.
Oh.
It was the perhaps scene.
I really understand that.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense to me. It feels like a very... It is just beautiful. It's really classy. It's really stunningly done. It's just full of quietness.
Mm.
It's a much quieter song than most of the other songs in the film, but it builds in a way that I just think he's really good at music. Like, I'm really glad that, but the Baz Luhrmann soundtracks have always been very important.
They're moments
in the films. They're real moments. And I think he is very good at going like, what is the perfect thing to give you that feeling you want in that moment? I think he does it extraordinarily well.
And even as much as I didn't like that Elvis movie, the ways in which the music moments.
Yeah, the importance of music and the way in which music is part of the storytelling are tremendous.
His sort of like musical awakening moment is one of the best things I've seen in a long time. It's just I didn't like the rest
of the
movie.
Yeah, I didn't like the rest of the stuff around it. But it is amazingly done, and that real like acknowledgement of the importance of music and what music does is amazing.
And even Gatsby, for all of its failings, which are many, that soundtrack bangs.
Slaps, it's really good. I am always, you know, so I looked up yesterday, I was doing like reading on Baz Luhrmann, and I did a lot of reading on everyone yesterday, found out Paul Mercurio, now a Labour MP. He went on to be a judge on Strictly Come Dancing in Australia. Uh-huh. And he's done a bunch of other things at various points, but now he is a Labour MP in a marginal seat.
Love that.
Love that for him. But I was looking at what Baz Luhrmann is like doing next, and he's just been, in the past month, like potentially brought up in conversation to direct another one of the Disney live action remakes of Tangled. And I don't know that we need loads of Disney live action remakes, but I really understand why you'd be like, I want this man to make a musical.
That's Tangled. I know it's a big one for a lot of people, not a big one for me, but I do think it's got some good songs. So.
It's got some great songs. And I think it's beautiful. I really love the imagery in it. And I imagine a live action remake of like the Festival of Lights and all of that being quite staggeringly beautiful.
Yeah.
And I can imagine him doing something like that. But I'm genuinely, the thing is, I am always chasing the feeling of the Red Curtain trilogy. Mm. I will see everything he does until the end of time. I will go and see every film he ever makes. I think that Strictly Ballroom is such a debut in the best possible sense, like meaning of that, in that it is a story he was burning to tell. He grew up with a mum who worked in a dance school.
Yeah, he danced.
He went to drama school. He understands like the importance of storytelling and of community making art and of throwing your life into this whole thing, and he wanted to tell that story, and it's like it really plays like a debut, but you know, I am still in love with what he makes. I just recently the past 15 years have not loved it, but I think that his films remain deeply part of me, and it always feels really nice to go like, oh, what's he gonna do next?
For all of the, I haven't enjoyed his later work, I can still props to him for them being big swings.
Yeah, you know what I mean? This is it. Like he's really specific about what he makes. He is.
And I don't like it, but I know he does.
Right.
And that actually matters more.
Totally. You know? And he's a director in that real sense of like, he's got such a clear style. He's got such a clear voice as a director. He's got such a clear thing he's trying to achieve. And regardless of whether I like it or not, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing.
And that we very much need to keep those directors
going.
Because otherwise we end up with just a slew of anonymous looking fucking movies.
Yeah.
Which this movie, this podcast, it's just is
not
all against.
It's not. And, yeah. Nobody could ever accuse. You texted me yesterday when you were like 5 minutes in. You were like, I had forgotten how much this film is.
Like, oh, just sort of comes out the gate like a fucking nervous greyhound and just bats. Yeah.
It could not have been made by anybody else. And that is a really great thing to be able to say of a piece of art.
I have to say that the older I get and the more I, you know, write for screen myself.
Yeah.
And like, which I is going to, you know, I often refer to screenwriting on this and it's like, it'll be years before I get anything
made. Sure, because that's how screen works.
Exactly. And, you know, I was 19 when I started my first blog. I was 26 when I got my first novel published. Yeah. So while I'm about 38, I might have something
greenlit. You might have something, exactly.
Right now I'm at school.
Yeah.
But the more I am exposed to how difficult it is to get things made.
Oh, yeah.
The more I am simply moved by original things getting made at all.
Yes.
So like Strictly Ballroom, the first 5 minutes I was already crying just because I was like, this is so specific.
Yeah.
And so mental.
And weird.
Yeah.
And not like, and you can't go to a pitch meeting and say, it's X meets X.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I'm trying to do something new.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do this thing that people aren't doing.
That's it.
That's a hard thing to pitch. We know that's a hard thing to pitch.
And we should really wrap up because we're running out of time. But I think as well, people can roll their eyes at like, oh yeah, it's a classic, Forbidden Love, Romeo and Juliet, West Side Story, blah, blah, blah. You know, she takes off her glasses movie. But it's like, we need the tropes of very well-loved stories where all the beats are automatic in order to like, they're the Gavin and Stacey's. They're the hen poles that we host the circus around. And I think people who are like, oh, here we go, she'll take her glasses off. Yeah. They're kind of missing the point.
They're missing the point because the circus is so good.
The circus, man, the circus.
It's just great.
Love the circus.
Love the circus.
And I love you. And now we
love
gotta
you
go.
Too. Now we gotta go.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Caroline.
Oh, shit. Let's do a plug.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So every time you've been on this podcast before, you've been like, I have a novel coming out, but it's so far away that we might as well not talk about it. And now it's not so very far away.
It's not so very far away. It's like 8 months away, which it still feels like ages. But we are doing an event about it.
We are!
In 2 months.
Yeah.
So I, for the first time, in 2 months' time, you will be able to come to Stroud Book Festival in Stroud, where I live, and listen to me and Caroline talk about my novel, Experienced, and you will be able to take a copy home, a proof copy home, 6 months before publication. I didn't know this was a thing.
Apparently, I've never heard of this.
I don't know.
They only do things like this when they're pretty sure the book is going to be a big fucking deal. So...
Well, thank you.
Definitely
want that. Yeah, I have this week had an email that says, great, we're ready for a copy edit. So I now feel like I have done my edits and that the book is a whole. But for everyone who does not live near Stroud, it will be coming out in May next year in lots of different places, which is very fun.
Yeah.
It's a big gay rom-com.
It's going to be great.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.